My name is Lisa Carol Secor. My attorney registration number is 25394. I'm admitted in Colorado and inactive in Wyoming. This case is about more than just getting more money for attorney's fees, as the appellate postulates it in their answer. This case is about setting the record straight and clearing up some statements about Ronnie Fisher's representation of a client in a very straightforward case. When you look at the record and what happened in the underlying case, it's very different than the way the appellate paints the picture of what happened. And the whole point on appeal is that the judgment of the trial court should be overturned if it's not supported by facts in the record. And I think the most important point in the appellate briefs is that the appellee does not point to any place in the record that supports the arguments that work to undermine the award of the attorney fee agreed to by the client. For example, one of the main points that the trial court uses, not only to say that the contingency fee shouldn't be granted, but also to say that the Lodestar fee shouldn't be awarded, there's actually three. The attorney didn't understand the law and tried to get a deficiency judgment, that he was dilatory in his preparation and caused delay running up his fee, and three, this business of forcing the client into a contingency fee agreement late in the case. None of that. The record actually belies all of that. First of all, look at the amended complaint. There is no claim for deficiency judgment. Why are we even talking about deficiency judgment? We had the appraiser who appraised the land in February of 2010, 6 weeks before trial, who said the property was worth $1.395 million. The remaining amount due on the note was $540,000. There was no issue of deficiency, and Ronnie Fisher did not make any issue of it. The court focused on that, directed by amend partners, to say he misunderstood the law. But what Ronnie Fisher was doing when he amended his complaint in December of 2009 was asserting fraud claims against the defendants and saying that the corporate veil should be pierced. Why? There are 60 paragraphs in the amended complaint that set forth the details of why. And that's not disputed anywhere by amend the appellee. Why? Because this note had gone through several iterations. They were, at the time of litigation, they were on the third amended note. The third amended note could not be found. That's why the public trustee foreclosure process couldn't be utilized. For all Ronnie Fisher knew, the defendants were going to contest that there was even a third amended note or the amount was what it was. He did have the letter from the defendant's attorney in 1999 that said the amount owed on the note was $732,000. But that was the last evidence there was of what was owed on the note. No one had that original note. Not only that, but the defendants had completely stripped this piece of land, stripped it of its mineral rights, and this wasn't learned till late in the litigation, stripped it of its mineral rights, stripped it of its water rights, and had let the taxes go for over 3 years. A tax lien was imminent. If the tax, and Ronnie Fisher testified at the trial that the trustee had, the public trustee had advised him, it may have been the treasurer, advised him that the tax lien holder intended to foreclose on the tax lien. If the tax lien were foreclosed on, that would have wiped out that collateral that was on that third amended note. Zero, zip, nada, a non-recourse note. Ronnie Fisher amended the complaint and said, hey, no way, you guys aren't getting away with this because you told my client that you owned the note, and he consented to change the collateral on the note because you're his old buddies, Farkas and Deutsch, you're his old buddies, and he relied on you, and you transferred this note to somebody he doesn't even know and doesn't even know if he can rely on or not. And not only that, you told him based on your relationship, that that property was worth more than the land that had been the collateral on the note. So over time, Mr. Amend had agreed to various collateral swaps. First it was one property, then another, ended up being four parcels divvied up among the total amount of the note owed. The amended complaint sets forth that Mr. Amend had originally sold the land for $1.34 million. And so the only thing now that was left, three of those parcels have been sold and paid off that part of the note that had been split up, and one was left for now $540,000 by the time we're at trial. But at the last land swap, the third time the collateral had been changed, Mr. Amin had been told that the property that he was agreeing to change it to was worth more than what he was releasing. That was not true. And that became very, very important in light of the context of that tax lien sale that was imminent. So Ronnie Fisher amended the complaint, asserted the fraud claims against the defendants. This, I can't even argue it, because I don't know how you can say Ronnie Fisher didn't know the law when I just gave you all those facts that show he was working hard to protect his client. Not only that, it's not just speculation on my part, because we have the end results. He did protect his client. He got that entire property, which the appraiser appraised at $1.3+ million. And the appraiser testified at the hearing that took into account the tax lien, that there was going to need to be a short sale to get it sold before the tax lien was foreclosed upon, took into account that the mineral rights were no longer applicable and that the water rights were no longer on the property. Not only did he get his client the full property, even though he was only owed $540,000 on the note did include attorney's fees and costs, so there's a little bit more there, but he got that full property worth $1.395 million. And immediately, before he had even acquired the deed in lieu of foreclosure on the property, Ronnie Fisher was immediately negotiating with prospective buyers to get that property sold so the tax lien wouldn't come in.
Let's assume all of this is
Mr. Fisher really did
an excellent job. I'm understanding the record, the court was looking at the contingent fee agreement and was and concluded that there was not a sufficient Rule 1.8 disclosure. And it looks to me that there's a considerable issue here as to whether the December 29 advice in the letter that said you have the right to discuss the contingent fee with independent counsel, that was not presented to the client again on January 20. And the question is, was it required to be presented? And then what's the consequences of all that?
All right. Well, I would argue that it couldn't be required every time you discuss the fee. Otherwise, all a client would have to do to avoid having to pay a fee is keep saying, well, I'm not sure I want to do it. And then when the attorney brings it up again, the attorney again has to say, you have the right to seek independent counsel. It's untenable because it would go on forever. It would never end. Not only that, in this specific...
Why is that untenable that it would go on forever? I mean...
I don't understand why that would be untenable. Why couldn't an attorney simply say, well, I'm going to terminate the representation.
This is going on
forever, and I'm not willing to stay around. I'm no longer going to represent.
And that's what he told him. And the client said, okay, well, I really want you to represent me because you're really doing a good job and I want to keep you on, so I'll go ahead and choose one of the fee agreements. Remember, there were three alternate fee agreements, not just the one contingency he ultimately signed.
Three in December. Were there three on January 20?
Yes, they discussed all three. The testimony says not only did they discuss it on January 20th, there's a discrepancy in the record about when in early January the attorney and client, the attorney remembered it being a little bit later in January, but the client testified that they had a discussion on January 2nd about all three options. And the attorney says, you got to choose one. And as Mr. Beck, the expert attorney at the trial, said, what the client really wanted and what the client told the attorney in early January is, I want a contingency fee that means I don't have to pay you anything, but if I win, I pay you the hourly fee. And he said, you know, that's just not acceptable. And Ronnie Fisher told his client he wasn't going to continue if he did that. He said he had a regular policy that when a client fell so far behind and didn't make satisfactory arrangements, he would terminate his representation. So this isn't a matter of exploiting someone at the last minute. It just happened to be that the decision was made by the client at that time. Ronnie Fisher testified at the hearing, I couldn't have just immediately quit representing the client. I would have had to file a motion to withdraw. There's a 15-day notice period, and the court still may not have let me out with the trial on March 18th. So I had to go forward with depositions that were scheduled in early February. I couldn't just stop working on the case. And if you look at the record, he did continue to work on the case. So this notion that there was a threat, do this, but, isn't supported in the record. And the client testified that late-night conversations were very common from the very beginning of the relationship.
Standard of review here of the trial court's decision is what?
The application of the facts to the law is an abuse of discretion standard. And I know that's tough, and normally it would be a little daunting, but the case law says if the conclusion is not supported in the record, that is, per se, an abuse of discretion. And I would submit that that's clearly the case here. For example, the court said he was that Ronnie Fisher was dilatory in his preparation and caused delays. How do you get that? What evidence is there of that? The answer was filed by the defendant August 12th. Within 2 weeks, Ronnie Fisher set trial on 9/23. He set that trial within 6 months. The court says, well, he didn't do any work till the last 80 days, or he did most of his work in the last 80 days. Well, from the time he set trial, there were only 140 days.
The appellee makes issue of no summary judgment to support that.
Okay, well, the argument on summary judgment is that there was really no question that the defendants owed the money on the promissory note. And that doesn't get us to where we need to go. You could have gotten summary judgment, but with a tax lien still going forward, the time for foreclosure, the redemption period, and all the times for executing on that, summary judgment would have been due December 23rd. The testimony and all the records show, they were diligently working on settlement and did settle February 12th. Well, by what Ronnie Fisher did, by keeping pressure on the defendants to settle and to get a good price for the land, he got a much better deal than he would have gotten if he just filed a motion for summary judgment and foreclosed on the note. His client would have just got $540,000 in attorney's fees and costs. He wouldn't have got a deal for $950,000 that he got through the Carlson purchase. So summary judgment only gets you so far. It's so what? And not only that, there really were disputed issues of material fact, because that promissory note was missing. And there was a question of fact about what was owed on the note. And there was a question about who was the proper party on the note because of all the iterations and the changes. Remember, they had originally sued an LLC called Respond Stritch. Then they found out later that Horizon 360 actually was the title holder to the property. So on December 23rd, when the summary judgment deadline went by, there were still questions of fact. And it's not the court's findings make it sound like Ronnie Fisher did nothing to try to find that out. He filed a motion to compel disclosures early on. He filed the first set of interrogatories early on, a second set of interrogatories on 12/29. He set depositions in November and December and January. The attorney for the defendants testified at the hearing that he went to the depositions that were noticed, but the clients never showed up. So they had to do a motion to compel attendance at the depositions. On February 2nd, the defendants, remember, Barry Schwartz testified that the defendants were infighting among themselves about who owed what and who held the land and who had the responsibility and who was going to step up to pay this debt. Well, on February, it was either 1st or 2nd, new attorneys for the defendants came in and filed a motion for protective order to ask the court to say they didn't have to attend depositions that had been set for February 3rd and 4th.
All of this was presented at the hearing before the trial.
Yeah.
Have time.
Oh, thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Philip Bledsoe. My registration number is 33606. Your Honors, this litigation needs to end, and I would urge you to end it with an affirmance of the trial court's decision below. I think the actual proper standard of review, based on what I heard about in the argument, is clearly erroneous without support in the record, because the argument I heard was really all about the facts, you know, the factual findings of the court. I didn't hear an argument here that there was any inappropriate legal standard applied or anything that might implicate a different standard. And of course, the law is very clear that the trial court's determination about the reasonableness of an attorney's fee is an abuse of discretion standard. The trial court's ample and well-supported factual findings make its 20% reduction of the Lodestar amount proper and fully within that discretionary standard. There's a three-day hearing below. There were five or six witnesses taken. In fact, there were more depositions taken on the attorney's fee litigation than there was in pursuit of Mr. Amend's rights in the underlying case, because there were no depositions ever taken in the trial below.
The C Corps says that the reason they were not taken was because they were acknowledged and not because the attorneys didn't show up and because the opponents
I believe it's correct that your opponents did not appear, but this is what happens when you cram all your activity into the last 2 months before trial. You run out of time to make that effective. It would be 09, Your Honor. I believe there were some notices for that time, and perhaps that's the case. But remember, on the record below shows, this three-day record, which there's ample support for the court's rulings, shows that what Mr. Fisher says to his client on January 20th, 2010, is, I've got depositions coming up. That's why if we don't get this fee taken care of, it's gonna go. So plainly there was discussion about depositions at this point.
Mr. The court was concerned that there was no effort to take summary judgment, and the C Corps says, for good reason, summary judgment just
I don't agree at all that missing that blowing the summary judgment deadline's a good practice here or was beneficial to the client. I think it's correct in part that it might not have gotten you everywhere you wanted to go, but it certainly would have simplified the trial. And remember, it is critical here that time is of the essence in this case because of this potential tax sale. Not only had the defendants in the case below not been paying Mr. Amend, they hadn't been paying their property taxes as well. And so you did have a tax sale issue here. This representation started in February of 09. The complaint's not filed until July of 09.
Priorities, let's assume that Mr. Fisher had successfully filed for summary judgment. And so then there was a foreclosure on property with a tax lien against Mr. Amend, tax lien. Simply lost the property? Would the tax lien take priority and he would have simply lost the property because he couldn't pay the tax lien?
The foreclosure certainly does not wipe out the tax lien. And he would have been forced to do or undertake what was ultimately the way out of this mess was to pursue a sale to a third party, because as the facts showed below, the ultimate resolution of the matter was sale of a third party, with that third party paying the taxes. But he would have had title at the time. He would have had the ability to go negotiate that on a much earlier basis. And so I believe it's just wrong to say that blowing the summary judgment was immaterial or in any way, shape, or form a good thing. Because one of the things that is critical here, and the trial court found that the contingency fee contract that was attempted to be imposed here, found under Rule 3 of Chapter 23.3, was that this contingent fee was unreasonable, unconscionable, and unfair. And I think one of the reasons, and the trial court, this is not a situation where sometimes we see in the court below that they haven't shown you all its reasoning. Plainly, there's an extended oral rendering of a decision, followed up by the amended judgment. So you've seen, and the court, I'm sure, has seen the court's extended reasoning here, relying on these facts. And one of the things that's important here is there's not really a contingency here. Where's the risk that the property's not going to come back? It's virtually nil. And that's one reason why, I believe, and accurately so, the court found that this contingent fee agreement was unreasonable, unconscionable, and unfair. And in any event, the law is plain that 1.5A always applies. There's always a general supervisory power of the trial court and of this court to review the reasonableness of an attorney's fee. And here, plainly, asking for $250,000 and then later bounced down to $140,000 and in even more is plainly unreasonable in light of the results obtained. And it was conceded below and conceded here that results were obtained. I mean, we did not urge below that no fee be awarded. We recognized that some work had been done by Mr. Fisher and that there was some advancement of the client's cause, but not at the level he was seeking, not on any kind of a contingency basis that could be considered appropriate. And so we urged the trial court, and ultimately the trial court agreed, that the lodestar be examined, the factors applied under 1.5A and that long-established Colorado law apply, and it be reduced by 20%, which is ultimately what the trial court below did. That's a reasoned approach, well-supported by the record, fully supported by the law of this state, and ought to stand so that this litigation can end. A couple of quick facts here, if you will. The trial court determined, and the record site is 1898, that the appraisal referenced by Ms. Secor was not relevant in his determination here for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is it didn't fully consider all of the underlying facts. The trial court noted not only was the summary judgment motion missed, that the trial management order listed virtually, I think, with one slight deviation, the same exhibits that were attached to the original complaint. There really wasn't the level of aggressive and fully competent representation suggested by Ms. Secor in her argument, and I'm still not sure there's understanding on Mr. Fisher's side of the fence about this issue on deficiency. It's not a question about a deficiency judgment. It's a question of whether or not the note is non-recourse, and that's why you can see, again, part of the record in Mr. Fisher's billing records, extended analysis, discussion, consideration about pursuing individuals extra contractually for fraud in the inducement or for piercing the corporate veil, ways to get to individual liability, because a deficiency isn't worth anything if the entity doesn't have any money. So certainly every lawyer we'll look at that issue from time to time, whether there's a basis to go beyond the corporate formality to see if there's a basis to do that here. But plainly there's not. And the trial court very plainly explains why that is. And in part, the evidence below shows that that was a factor in the settlement considerations that existed in this case. Yes.
Pause a minute. Having difficulty following if the standing balance on the note was something on the order of $550,000 in the property. It's $900,000.
There was a foreclosure and the property was taken. How would there be any kind of deficiency? I mean, once you have the property,
And there may well not have been likely to be a deficiency, but I think what was being sought here was not just the property back, but cash. I mean, Mr. Amen, the record fully shows, had sold this property, and one of the reasons he had it sold and wanted it sold in the way he had was so that he would have an installment income for his life. And so income is what Mr. Amen was looking for. And so there is a need to look about whether there's cash. Now, obviously, the property's better than the cash, because you've got to turn around and resell it again and deal with this tax liability and all of those kinds of things. So the non-recourse, you know, deficiency issue doesn't really go to the way that Mr. Fisher's counsel argued on that. And it's also the case that that the settlement discussions that ultimately led to the sale that did occur, the option agreement and the sale that occurred, there were discussions with the third party that ultimately bought this property immediately before January 20th. I believe one of the time records of Mr. Fisher in this case, which are reasonably well detailed, show on that very day that he had had a discussion with Mr. Carlson, which is the third party here. And so again, I think when you step back and you say, I want to apply a contingency to property that I'm clearly going to get back because this loan's in default, this property is going to be returned, it's fully inappropriate to have a contingent fee arrangement here. And whether or not that it's because of the failure to comply with Rule 1.8, which I believe the record fully supports, 1.8 was not applied here, or correctly applied here, or whether it's just under the court's general supervisory powers of 1.5a and Rule 3, or Rule 3 under 23.3, there's ample legal basis, a full record support below, that this judgment should be affirmed in full, and that this litigation ought to end. We shouldn't be here to quote-unquote set the record straight. We ought to be here to correct something that was incorrectly legally decided below. That didn't happen here. And we urge the court to affirm the case below in all respects. And I've got time left, but I was told a long time ago when you were done, sit down. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The case now stands submitted. We will issue an opinion in due course.